Okay.
Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Tracy Smith over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Tracy, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in Pasadena, California. And you want the exact date and all that?
Or just the year is fine.
Okay, 1945. I was born in 1945.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Arcadia, California.
And when did you first become interested in sports or athletics? And what was your earliest participation like?
You mean in track and field are you talking, or any sport?
Any sport. What was the first sport that you were involved with?
Probably that was really organized with Little League Baseball. I thought I was going to become a baseball pitcher.
So you had visions of being a big league pitcher someday?
Yeah. You know, my favorite thing in elementary school was recess. I just couldn't wait to get out there, and I was playing all kinds of sports, and baseball was the one I really liked that I first got into an organized Little League thing. And then I, had visions of being a great athlete. I always thought, even from my youngest elementary years, that I wanted to be a great athlete in some sport. That was my big goal. I mean, from really early on. And then when I got in high school, I wanted to go out for football, but I was a pretty scrawny little guy, and my parents said they didn't want me to go out because they were afraid I'd get hurt in football, but that was the popular thing to do. But they wouldn't buy my football shoes, so I couldn't play football. And then I remembered one time during a school, like elementary field day at the end of the school year, they had a bunch of events, and one of them was to run one lap around the field, which was a fairly large field, and I just sprinted around the whole thing and won by a huge margin. I thought, man, that was fun. I'm pretty good at that. So that's my first inklings that I might be a good runner. But I used to run home. My house was about a half a mile from the school, and I used to run home as fast as I could to have a little longer lunch. I'd run home from the school to home and then back after I ate. And I always liked to see how fast I could do it. So those were my first ideas that I had some ability to run.
Mm-hmm. And what motivated you to want to be an athletic star or a track star?
It came from just this desire within me to be great at some sport. You know, like I said, I thought it was going to be baseball early on. And then when I couldn't play football in high school, I decided, a friend said, why don't you go out for cross country? And I didn't know what it was. And he told me it was a big, long race around the school. And I remembered back to that field day. And I knew that when my parents had a mountain cabin, I used to run up there at the 7,000-foot elevation just for the fun of it. And I knew I liked to run, so I went out and won the JV race by about a minute, the first race, and then I was hooked. And I said, this is a sport, when I was a freshman, that I'm going to pour all my energy to be the best I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started thinking, instead of baseball, I thought, I'm going to be a great track athlete.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I just loved that first victory and the feeling, and I loved the feeling of running and doing so well. So that's where it all started.
Did you happen to have any idols or heroes at that time that you looked up to that were track stars or other types of athletes?
Yeah, there was a guy named Herb Elliott. He was the world record holder in the mile when I was a freshman. And I remember even he went, you know, he trained in Australia. He was an Australian guy, and he used to have a unique coach that trained him out at the place called Port C. It was a place on the coast where all these sand dunes. And I read his book and all this about him, this Herb Elliott training in the sand dunes. And I even wrote him a letter asking if I could come train at his training camp. I was so wanting to get the best training I could so I could be the best runner I could be.
Well, tell me a little bit about your track successes and major wins leading up to the 68 trials.
Okay, well, the big change for me is, I was very successful in high school. I won the California State High School Mile, I ran 4:12. And I went to Oregon State, but I kept getting injured, and so I was, you know, even I just was not happy running in college. They were running me too many miles. Anyway, to make a long story short, I started training with a Hungarian coach named Mihály Igloy, and he was a Hungarian national coach. And then in the 56 Olympics, he defected to the United States, and I started training under him. And boy, then I got a huge improvement in 1966, my first year with him. I went to a world cross-country meet over in Rabat, Morocco, and no American had done very well up to that time ever in that event, and I was a totally unknown, and I ended up placing third in that event, and it surprised me and surprised a lot of other people. I even got to talk on the Voice of America right after the race. So that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then that gave me a lot of confidence. And from then on, I would say I was a world-class runner. I mean, it gave me confidence, but also physically this guy was training me. And every time I ran into, I got a lot of invitations to big meets and ran for the U.S. team that summer. Ran USA versus Poland and against Australia. And it was just, that was my breakthrough year, was 1966. And then I was in a race in 1967, indoor race in Oakland, California, and I set the world record in the indoor three mile. And then again in 1968, before the Olympic Games, I broke my own record in the indoor 3 mile up in Toronto. And then I ran I won the Olympic trials in the 10,000 meters. And at Lake Tahoe, I had won they had two Olympic trials that year. They had one in Los Angeles, and I won the trials in the 5,000, and I won the trials in the 10,000 there. And then I went to Tahoe, and I could have run in both races, but I ran the 10,000. That was the first meet of the year, and I won it. And I thought, I got a lot of teammates that I don't want to cut them out. I thought, man, I'll have enough pressure on me just running one race in Mexico City. So I chose not to try out in the 5. But anyway, then I ended up getting 11th in Mexico City as the first American, but I was pretty disappointed because I ran 15 seconds slower than I did at the Olympic trials. And at the Olympic trials, I felt like if I would have been pressed, I could have run probably 15 seconds faster than I did there at Lake Tahoe, which would have put me in the top 5 if I would have run, you know. But I think I was kind of past my peak when I ran in Mexico City, because my workouts, you know, it was everything you could do you had to peak to make the Olympic team. It was so hard to make the team that I peaked my training to make the team. And then it was kind of hard to hold it for another month to the Olympics. But anyway, that's kind of my take on how I did there. I was first American, so I felt good about that. There was 36 people in the race, so I was in the top third anyway.
Yeah, that's very good. Sure. So what was your coach doing differently from the previous coaches you had had? How was he different?
Well, his training was totally, totally unique. You know, when he came here to the United States in 1964, I think it was, he defected from the United, from Hungary because the Russians were moving in, and he brought his family here. Anyway, he started a club, and all of a sudden, Americans, a guy named Jim Beatty, who, you know, broke the first sub-4-minute mile indoors, and a bunch of guys, Bob Shuel trained with him and won the Olympic gold medal in Tokyo, and he really developed some world-class runners right away. But his training program was totally different. Even to this day, nobody trains people like he did, except for a few people that were his athletes at that time that are training people. But it was basically interval training every day, every morning, every afternoon. You were running around the track. You weren't being timed on most days. You were just running at different efforts. And being a long distance runner, you're not running real long intervals, like running half miles and then running another half mile. You're running short things like 200 meters or at the longest 600 meters, but you might do the 200 meters in a day. You might run 40 of them, and you might run 10 600s in a day. And but they were, there was not a lot of pressure. It was in fact, most of us ran on our own effort and didn't, even though there was a lot of people out there, we didn't run with each other. We just ran what my good effort was, or my hard effort was, or my all-out effort. And so you didn't have the pressure of running under for time each day, where a lot of coaches have you under the watch quite a bit of the week. So anyway, his system worked well for me, and just as it had worked well for others. And I still incorporate it into the high school kids that I coach. I'm not totally training them like an Igloo athlete, but I have a combination of things I do, and Igloo is part of it. So it's basically very boring. I used to get a headache as soon as I'd walk through the gate to the track where we train, because I knew that I was going to go through some pretty hard, rigorous stuff, and it was going to be painful. It was going to be long, not so painful. It was kind of a dull pain, because it just went on for like 2.5-3 hours of running around the track and, you know, being bored and running the same place. But because I was getting so much success, I was willing to submit myself to not being to getting headaches when I walked through the gate there.
Yeah. Well, how was your training and competition financed at this time?
Back then, Avery Brundage was the head of the Olympic Committee, and he was strict on the amateur code. And if you accepted any money, the only thing you could get was shoes. But you could get your way paid to meets, and that was about it. You could get equipment for free, and you could get your way paid to meets, but no money. And here he is, a wealthy man. He was making all kinds of money. I wouldn't even be surprised he made money off the Olympics. But anyway, I was in the Army actually when I was running, so I didn't need a job, because my orders in the Army was to train for the Olympic Games. And I was getting a monthly paycheck, and they were, so I didn't need to have a job. It was probably the closest thing I could get at the time to what the Russians were doing. Most of the Russian great athletes were in the military as well, and they were kind of professional athletes. I mean, we were actually, getting our monthly paycheck was really for doing our sport, but it wasn't considered that, so we weren't in violation of the amateur code. So anyway, that I dropped out of Oregon State School so I could get drafted, so I'd have more time to train and I could be near my coach and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
How did your friends and family react to finding out that you made the Olympic team?
They were really excited, especially my grandparents. I remember one of the first calls. Well, my parents were there at the Olympic trials, and they were just bouncing up and down. We went over to some friend's house in Lake Tahoe and had dinner, and it was a thrill. But anyway, my grandparents, who I'd lived with during some of the hardest training I had under this Igloo, I lived with them during the summer because my parents had a fishing resort up in Central California in the Sierra Nevadas, and so they had to go up there, but I couldn't go up there. I needed to be near my coach. And they sacrificed a lot to help me, get my rest and feed me, and so I knew they were pretty proud of me. They'd be proud of me if I made the Olympic team, and they were getting up in age, and I called them, and that was a real neat thing. They were really, my grandmother made me a special scrapbook from high school on, and especially an Olympic scrapbook, and that was pretty cool.
Definitely. Well, were you worried about the altitude of Mexico City before you went down for the Olympics? Were you at all concerned?
I got worried about it because Igloo, I said, what are we going to do about this altitude situation? And he said, oh, I have training that we can do that will work for that, And I was kind of skeptical. I'd always trusted him in everything. Each year he added on about another half hour of training, and I was kind of getting really dead tired from his training, and mentally I was getting more, I was not enjoying it. And, like I said before, I didn't enjoy the training, but I was being successful, so I kept at it. And I finally left Igloo over this concern about, everybody that was in the top 10 in the country got to go to Lake Tahoe, got their way paid to Lake Tahoe to train for the trials that were at Lake Tahoe, because they were at Lake Tahoe so they could see who ran well at altitude. And he said he was going to train me, and then I'd go up there, you know, train at sea level and go up there and run at altitude, but I didn't go along. So I broke away from him like in January of 68, or no, it was a little later than that. It was probably March or something, because I ran that indoor world record when I was still with him in 68, and that must have been in like February. But anyway, after that, it was a hard decision, but I left. And but I luckily I'd kept a training log of all the workouts I ever had with him. And I was kind of aware that the guys that left him, like Bob Shule, who won the 64 Olympic Games, he left before he ran in the 64 Games, and he was much better after he left him. And I kind of had that in the back of my mind, that the guys that left him ran better later, and it was mainly because they had kind of got their apprenticeship through a way of super hard training, and then they did the same workouts, but not the quantity of it. They cut back about half. And so that's what I did. I cut back and I started really feeling good. That was when I started really running faster and feeling better. And that's why I think I won the trials. But the thing about altitude, my parents, like I said, they were gone up to this fishing resort up near Bishop, California, Bishop Creek Lodge, it was called. And it was at 8,000 feet. So I started, when I was at Tahoe, I'd come down on weekends and there was a road up there that was flat for a mile. And I used to do repeat miles at 9,500 feet, so I was probably one of the best prepared athletes for altitude, other than people that went to school, like over in, Adams State College, I forget where but it's got sand dunes and it's at 7,000 feet, and a lot of our athletes didn't go to Tahoe, they went there, Adams State College. Anyway, people that went to college at altitude, they maybe had a little more advantage over me. But I was up at Bishop, California every summer training. And my dad had that fishing or that cabin that I talked about when I was in high school. We went and trained. I used to run just for the joy of it. And I think I was just physiologically, I think I had spent enough time at altitude that I had a little bit of an edge on the rest of the people that were sea level runners. But I didn't have an edge on the people at Mexico City, like the Kenyans that lived at altitude all their lives, or the Ethiopians that lived there. Their whole physiology was different.
Sure.
Yeah. There was like four people ahead of me that were sea level athletes in Mexico City. There's only the rest of them, the other seven were all the Ethiopians or Kenyans. So I think altitude made a big effect on the race at Mexico City.
Definitely, especially in your event.
Yeah.
Well, in the weeks leading up to the games, did you remember hearing anything about possible boycotts by members of the U.S. track team?
No, I do remember when we were at Lake Tahoe. I can remember Bill Bowerman, the founder of Nike, he was not the head coach up there, but he was the distance coach. And I remember, I don't know if this was what you're referring to, but they had two Olympic trials, like I said before, one in LA and then one at Tahoe. And the thing was, if you won the LA trials, you were guaranteed to make the Olympic team. That was what they said, if you kept your form. And then when we got to Tahoe, just the week before we had our trials, the trials, they changed it. They said, you're not guaranteed a spot on the team based on how you did in L.A. If you won the trials. Because they had said, if we won the trials, we're guaranteed to be on the team if we kept our form, and which was kind of nebulous as to what they meant by that. And so they said, you had to do it at the trials in Lake Tahoe to be on the team. And a lot of people were upset with that, especially, and I was one that was not, I thought, man, because I had felt like, well, I'm on the team. I just got to stay in good shape. And as it turned out, I remember saying something to Bowerman. I said, I really peaked for the LA meet because I wanted to win so that I'd have the pressure of knowing I was on the team. And, other people spoke out about it. And I don't remember if it ever got to the boycott point, but it only affected a couple people. Couple distance runners. The guy that won the 10,000, the one that won the 10,000 in L.A. Yeah, actually, it wasn't. I can't remember. Yeah, I guess I didn't run the 10,000 in LA. We just won the 5,000, but I was able to run the 10,000. Anyway, the guy that affected, two people that affected is a guy that won the 10,000 in LA and a guy that won the 1,500 meters in LA. They both didn't make the Olympic team. They're both like fourth in the games, in the trials, and they had to be third. And you know, they kept their form, but they didn't quite do it. And they had to be really disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you were referring to, the boycott, or was there something else? I don't remember anything about boycott.
Oh, the Olympic Project for Human Rights. It was some of the African American track team members who were involved in a civil rights protest.
I remember vaguely that was going on, yeah, because I remember, obviously the big thing that happened, you know, was Tommy Smith and John Carlos standing on the victory stand with their raised fists and black gloves, and I remember at meets early on, my biggest impression was there was this big, tall, black man with a shaved head, and I got to know that he was a sociology professor at San Jose State who was, you know, kind of drumming up support for that boycott. At least that's what I understood. I can't quote for sure that that's what it was, but I was led to believe this guy was stirring those guys up because those guys were pretty nice guys, and they didn't seem like the militant type, but I think Harry Edwards had a lot to do with that. But I don't want to get in trouble and get sued for libel.
No, you're fine. You're fine. So did you remember ever receiving a letter about supporting the Olympic Project for Human Rights or just supporting your fellow athletes?
I don't remember anything like that.
Uh-huh.
I do remember the guys being ushered, the guys that did that, those two guys being ushered out of the stadium, And then later I got my initials are T. Smith, Tracy Smith. I got a telegram from Arthur Ashe congratulating Tommy Smith on his victory.
Oh.
And I wish I would have saved it. I should have even sent it to him later, but I don't know whatever happened to it. I wish I had it now. I would have sent it to him. He'd probably mean a lot to him.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah. What about the protests that were going on in Mexico and the deaths that happened there?
I heard about that, you know, and it talked about that there was a lot of bloodshed, and, you know, I wasn't one that was really in tune to national, worldwide politics or those kind of things. I just knew this. It was a student riot kind of thing, and I didn't really know what it was about. But, you know, now if I think, you know, now the way I am, I would have really been on top of that watching CNN, but I didn't watch the news much then. I was just focused on my sport, so I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to that. I was aware that there was some bloodshed and the military had to be called out. And I remember thinking, guy, they may not have Olympic Games. They talked about that, the possibility it wasn't going to happen. I remember having that fear.
Yeah, that must have been an alarming time.
Yeah, that was kind of for that fact mainly only. I wanted to be in the Olympic Games. I didn't want it to be canceled.
Well, when you finally did get to Mexico for the start of the Games, what were your impressions of the city and the people there?
I really loved it. You know, I went on the floating gardens, Xochimilco, I think it was called. And there was a marimba band, and I met some girls that I kind of went out and had some time, fun times, you know, going dancing and stuff. And the people were very, you know, genuine, and it was a good time down there. I remember, I think the highlight for my dad, I went out to eat at a pretty nice restaurant in Mexico City. And sitting right behind us was the mayor of L.A., a guy named Sam Yorty, who was a mayor, I don't know, multiple terms down there in Los Angeles. And my dad, man, he was into politics, and here this Sam Yorty was right behind us. That was pretty cool. And I remember going down with one of my teammates, a distance runner, Marty LaCourie, who was a freshman from Villanova that made the team. I went down to Acapulco, and we stayed where all the yachting people, the beautiful hotel right on the cliffs overlooking our little patio, overlooked the cliff divers there in Acapulco. And that was really cool. So I had a really good time, you know, meeting the people, seeing a lot of, like, going to Acapulco and experiencing all that. I felt bad for one of my teammates, the guy that was second to me in the trials. I think he got last at the 10,000, and he was so fed up. We were in the first event of the track and field, and I don't know if it was, I don't think it was, it might not have, it might have even been the first event of the whole Olympic Games, but we were the first event, and then the pressure was off to go do things, and he was so upset about finishing where he did that he got on a plane, I think, the next day and went home. I wonder how he feels about that now.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Tom Lowe probably wants you to interview him.
I'm sure, definitely. What was his name again?
His name was Van Nelson.
Oh, Van Nelson. I think that I have talked to him. I think we have interviewed him, actually. I didn't do the interview, but one of my colleagues did.
Yeah, I bet he has regrets about that, but I've actually got his phone number. If Tom gave me his phone number, I need to call him sometime and catch up on things with him.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, I just remember what was really interesting after, you know, is how easy it was to sneak people into the Olympic village. You know, if you had, like, we got a lot of Adidas gear, like Adidas bags, and kind of figured out that if I gave an Adidas bag to my dad or something, he could walk right into the Olympic village with me, which, you know, the next Olympics was the one where they really, you know, there was an awful tragedy, and that was, Mexico City was so easy and so free, so much freedom to be, even bring relatives in to see what was going on, and anyway, you know, I didn't realize how special that was until the 72 games when those wrestlers and people were killed, you know, by the Palestinian Liberation Front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
What did you think of the accommodations in the Olympic Village?
They were nice, yeah. They had these, you know, concrete, tall dormitories, and they had it's probably them that, you know, we had beds, and on the bed was like a bedspread that had, it was in green and Mexico written on it, Mexico City 68. And I thought they did a really first class job. And you know, the food was good. Facilities. They had all kinds of training tracks you could go to that had, you know, at that time, they were just beginning to develop these all-weather tracks, whereas, you know, there were still a lot of tracks in our country that were, even the big name tracks were cinder tracks, and we went down there. I never had to train on a cinder track, and they had all these different places you could go to train, so you didn't have to get on a real crowded track, and that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was really relaxing in the Olympic Village. Got to, you know, they had a swimming pool there, and they even had a training track there. And then they had an auditorium, and I remember going and seeing a lot of cultural dances from different countries. And I remember playing a recreation room, playing ping pong with some Iraqis, and, you know, before Iraq was really a well-known country. I knew where it was, but I never knew it would be such a major political thing on the world scene. So, I mean, that was really exciting for me to, you know, get involved with all these other countries. Russian athletes was pretty cool to play, like, ping pong with and trade pins with. And probably one of the best things I traded was we traded pins, and a lot of people traded their, we got a team T-shirt, and most of the other teams, countries did too. And I went up to a guy named Ralph Dubell, who happened to win the gold medal. And this was after he'd won his gold medal in the 800 meters from Australia. And he wanted to trade me his team T-shirt for my team T-shirt. And I thought, that's a real deal, man. I'm getting a T-shirt from a gold medalist. And even to this day, when I go speak places, I show that and I talk about, this is from a gold medalist that I traded. And so he got an American shirt, but it was from not a gold medalist.
That's a pretty neat story.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. But yeah, I'm always showing that and telling how that's from an Olympic champion and how I try and take good care of it so it doesn't fall apart. Yeah.
Well, what are your memories of the opening ceremony?
That was probably a disappointment for me. I mean, it was really spectacular. It was fun to watch, but because I was going to run the next day and they told me that it was going to be standing on our feet for a long time, I was in the stands and didn't march in.
Hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, I feel a little regret on not doing that. But you know, you wanted to do everything the right way before your race, and but they, you know, they had to stand for quite a while, and wanted to, you know, the athletes want to get off their legs, especially the day before a big meet.
Absolutely. Well, so yeah. You got to.
But
watch.
It was really exciting. The one thing that was kind of funny is that they let go all these pigeons, and the pigeons had trouble finding their way out of the stadium. They kept swirling around in there and getting caught up in the upper balcony areas. They had trouble, and it was kind of comical, but I think they finally found their way out, but that was a comical thing.
Well, since 1968 was kind of a height of the Cold War, what effect, yeah, if any, did that have on relationships or interactions with members of Soviet bloc teams?
You know, I remember, like I was saying, I've got some Soviet pins, and I remember playing ping pong with the Soviets. And I knew one of the guys in my race was, there was three Russians in my race, and one of them was a guy that was second to me when I set the world record in 1968 in 3 mile indoors in Toronto. And, you know, they were just super friendly and nice, and, you know, it was kind of interesting that these guys are, you know, their country's our enemy, but, you know, it was kind of an interesting encounter, but it was a friendly one. Well, this is a little bit related. Richard Nixon, I believe he was president at that time, he really wanted all the athletes, you know, I didn't realize how important anybody that had any fame was to help him win elections, because he sent me, and I'm sure lots of other people, congratulations on being in the Olympic Games, and he sent about a dozen golf balls with his name on it. I still have those.
Oh, wow.
Printed on there, yeah. The golf balls with Richard Nixon written on them. So that was pretty interesting, too. I mean, I wish it would have been signed. It just was a printed, you know, with a printer.
Yeah.
But that was pretty cool.
Definitely interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's ever brought that up, but...
No, I don't think I've heard that one yet. Not about the golf balls. I think I've heard about, you know, invitations to meet with him for publicity reasons, but not the golf balls yet.
Yeah, and I remember track and field, which was Track and Field News, which is the biggest newspaper that had anything to do with track and field in those days. Now they got all these running times and Runner's World, but Track and Field News was the place, and they had a banquet. And I remember hearing it was mainly Americans that were there, but you know, some of the ones that got invited to answer questions in front of, at the banquet. And there were some pretty interesting stories there. Sometimes it was just athletes that didn't really do much in the games, but that they had done something back in our, you know, in the USA and in some, like in the NC2A. The guy Bob Day from UCLA won the NCAA in a really unique race, and I remember him being interviewed and learned. It was kind of interesting to hear how that race went, you know. So it was just a lot of neat things, not all totally related to the games. I mean, it came about because of a banquet with all the people at the games, but you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, 68 was also the first year that they implemented kind of a standardized drug testing program in the summer games.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was drug tested right after my race, the first time I'd ever been drug tested. And it wasn't a blood test, it was a urine test, and they had to hold me for a while, because, man, after a 10K, you're kind of dehydrated, and I don't know if you were allowed to have water then, I can't remember, but it finally was successful. Yeah.
Well, how did you feel about it, having to do the drug test after your race?
It was no big deal to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know... I think at the time I thought distance run. You know, there was people on our. It was usually, I mean, I knew about. There was talk of people using drugs. It was mainly the throwers that in track and field that were heard of. They were thought of as doing the muscle gaining kind of drugs, doping. Not EPO, the anabolic steroids.
Uh-huh.
And those were legal, and, you know, it was suspected, you know, I knew that, but I was thinking, my thought was, no distance runner is going to want to put on bulk, you know, through steroids. The only drugs that I knew of was the ones that put muscle on, and I thought it's kind of ridiculous that they're doing this to me. I remember thinking that, and because I knew that, I was pretty sure there was a lot of the throwers were doing it, but I had no proof.
Yeah. What about with the endurance sports? Were they concerned at all about use of, like, speed or methamphetamine?
No, I don't think they were. I mean, I was pretty naive about that, and I didn't even think about that kind of stuff. I never thought about anything like that, and, you know, it was the next Olympics that they kind of thought that maybe the big winner in the 5K and the 10K, Lasse Virran from Finland, that he had blood doped, you know, that he had taken had his blood taken out and then put back in so that he'd have more red blood cells. So that's one of the big things they do in the Tour de France. So anyway, no, there wasn't, you know, I didn't even know about blood doping till, you know, like 3 or 4 years later. So I was pretty naive about anything that could enhance my performance, and I wasn't interested in that either in any way.
Yeah.
I do remember there was a big story about, you know, there were a lot of athletes that got money under the table, and I don't feel bad for them. I feel like it was wrong in any way now looking back on it. There was a big story about the people that went into the Olympic Village to some room where the Adidas were giving out their equipment, and they were getting their shoes, and that there was money in the shoes. That was a big thing back then. And I don't know if it ever happened. I know I didn't get any money in any shoes. I'm not sure if I got any shoes at the Olympic Games. I think I had all the shoes I needed before the Games. But I do have to say that Puma, you know, I mean, guys went over to Europe, and over in Europe, you know, it was common knowledge that you got money under the table for appearance fees if you were really well-known. You had to be really well-known. You had to be right at the top of your event. And there was a lot of people that made a lot of money, I mean, considered a lot of money in those days, under the table money. And I do know that when I won the trials, a representative from Puma came to me and said, "Hey, would you consider wearing Puma shoes rather than Adidas shoes?" And I thought, man, they've been so good to me. They give me all these shoes. They give me sweatsuits, and they give me this and that. And I said, they've been so good to me. And they said, "Well, are your parents going to the games?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, they said, "How are they going to get down there?" I said, "They can't afford to fly. They're going to drive." And they said, "Well, you know, we could help them get down there." And then I was kind of catching on what they were talking about, which would have been illegal. That would have violated the amateur code, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no, I can't do that. I was pretty naive at that time. I didn't know all this other stuff was going on. I might have got interested if I knew that everybody was getting away with it.
So what is your take on amateurism then versus now? What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a hard one. You know, I actually, after the 68 games in 1974, I went into the first professional track outfit called the International Track Association. It was an attempt to earn money, let athletes make money. But it was on the up and up. They called it International Professional Track Association. You know, and it helped me get my first house. You know, I made $10,000 for signing up, and I was guaranteed $10,000 for the year. And, you know, and I needed that. You know, I put a lot of time in and didn't get started in a career till quite a bit after most people my age, you know. And so I feel like I missed out. I wish I was running in this generation to be able to do what they did. And I would have run longer, would have run more years if I would have known that I could make a living, you know, and put away money. And maybe, you know, if I was running at the top of my game in this country now, like guys are doing, it would have been pretty well off,
mm-hmm.
which I feel I would have deserved, you know, because I put a lot of hours into it. But, you know, I'm starting to wonder about what has driven people to do. I don't know if there is a lot of blood doping in the distance races. I know there's been some distance runners that have actually quit running distance when it looked like they were going to get tested. They kind of retired real quickly. So I wouldn't, that kind of thing hasn't been good for the sport. And I think money is the reason for those. I think money is the reason drugs come into it, because people want, you know, they'll do anything to make the money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a bad thing, but I wouldn't have abused it, I don't believe.
Yeah.
And I don't think the distance runners are doing that. I don't really think they're doing anything, you know, to my knowledge.
Okay. What about the gender verification testing that was conducted in 1968 during the games? Do you remember hearing anything about that?
I remember about these sisters from Russia that they kind of wondered about. The press sisters, Irina and something press. I remember something about them. You know, they're checking their genes to see if they're fully women. Yeah. I don't remember. I thought it was kind of the first time I'd ever heard of something like that. So it was kind of interesting, but, you know, there wasn't too much done about it or said about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they actually did test them, but I vaguely remember that.
What about the Smith and Carlos protest on the middle stand? Did you happen to be there and witness it in person?
I was at the games because I remember seeing them run the 200 meters, and I must have seen it. I don't remember. You know, I can't remember. You know, there was so much written about it. It seems like I saw it. I mean, I saw so many pictures of it, but I remember seeing the race. And it's funny. I don't know if I saw it in person. Probably did, because I think they had the ceremonies pretty close to after the race.
Mm-hmm.
I may not have understood what was going on at the time.
Okay. Well, what do you recall of people's reactions at that time or after, immediately afterwards?
I don't really get other people's reaction. I know my reaction was that track and field had been good to all athletes, including the black athletes, and those guys had gotten scholarships. And I was kind of thinking, they've had our country has done a lot of good things for them. And, you know, they got to represent their country. They got their way paid here. They got the uniforms. They got all kinds of things. And that was my take on it then. And even now, they weren't militant type guys at the time. They just kind of got pushed into it, I believe, by a very militant guy, Harry Edwards. And, you know, I think that they never were, you know, they were not the racial type. You know, I knew those guys. I really liked them. And they didn't seem like, you know, they were, you know, very prejudiced against whites. They seemed like good guys. So I kind of felt like it was a betrayal of America when they did it. You know, that's the way I felt.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand now, you know, that. You know, there was back in the 60s like that, there was still a lot of the segregation and problems with the races. And I could see where that could take place. I could see where it could, you know, come about.
Mm-hmm.
I understood that part of it.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was the place to do it. And especially, I didn't think the Olympic Games was the place to do that.
Hmm.
Especially to athletes that have been treated so favorably.
Mm-hmm. What about the media? What are your memories of the media there? For example, did you have any interactions with journalists or photographers? Did anybody talk about seeing the games on TV back home?
What was that last part about? Did they talk about what?
Did any of your friends or family talk about seeing the games on TV back home and what the coverage was like?
No, I don't remember any reaction. I do remember reactions about my race, people saying that they had the camera on me quite a bit of the early part of the race, because I was figured to do pretty well, and that's probably why that Puma guy wanted to get me in his shoes, but I was figured to be in the top five by a number of, in Track and Field News, they had a bunch of people that rated who was going to be in the top anyway. So feedback I got on the media was that they showed me until I was kind of getting out of the picture as far as being in a medal contention.
Hmm.
That's all I knew.
So some of your friends and family back home did get to see you on TV?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they said that I was on, in fact, even now, I'd like to see it. Somebody finally found a clip of what must have been the TV coverage of my race. And it's on our Facebook at the team that I coach with. And I'm not real good with Facebook, and so I haven't seen it yet. I tried to find it one day. I'm going to have to get my head coach to show me. He said, yeah, they showed you right up close there for a while, but in the end they didn't. So I think it was the TV somewhere. They found the, you know, they found in the archives that race, and it was probably on YouTube or something, and he got it off of there.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I'd like to see it, because I never did, you know, I never did see it right after when I got home. They didn't have it on, and they didn't have VCRs then to record that kind of stuff.
Well, did you get to witness some of the other remarkable achievements at those games?
I was, you know, I'll never forget. I was like two rows up. I mean, I was right virtually down on the right in front of the pit when Bob Beamon jumped a foot over the world record, or more than a foot over the world record in the long jump. And it was incredible. And they had a little kind of a, you know how they measure, they usually take a tape measure and take it from the board where they jumped out to the foot, the back, the furthest point back on of any part of the body that touched the sand. And they had to, but anyhow, this was really the modern, you know, here we are at the game. So they weren't using a tape measure. They had this kind of a rail that was about waist high that they'd take, and it was kind of like a surveying thing. They'd look through it and they'd line it up with the mark on the sand, and then it would give them a reading of how far it was, so they didn't have to use a tape measure. And Bob Beamon jumped further than that little rail went out, so they couldn't measure. They had to go get a tape measure.
Wow, that must have been something to see.
You know, I was there to watch a guy named Ralph Boston compete against a guy named Igor Taravanishin, who both guys were going to be maybe the first guys to do 28 feet, and it was questionable about who was going to win the gold. And Beamon was not our winner in the trials, I don't believe. And then he just shocks everybody. He was one of the first jumpers, and he does this huge jump, and he's just crying on the track, and everybody's couldn't believe it. And it was perfect conditions, and then it started pouring rain right after that. It was, I mean, those guys, everybody else after that had to be totally psyched out without the weather coming in. I mean, they had to be psyched out even if it was perfect weather. Even if they had a wind behind them, they had to be psyched out. But all of a sudden, this unbelievable thing of, you know, a track and field happened that's never, you know, just unbelievable the way he broke that record. And then they get rain on top of it and they got to compete.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Like they're competing for second for sure. They're not even thinking about winning it anymore. So, yeah, that was pretty cool being there to see. That was really a historic, you know, and I saw most of the track events. I felt bad about the guy that had won the 64 games and the 68 games in the marathon, Abibi Bikila. He was going to be in the third games, and I think he got 14th or something like that. But his teammate won the marathon, a guy named Mama Woldy. I remember that pretty distinctly. And I went to, I think I saw Holmes, the boxer. Can't think of his. Anyway, I went and saw some of that. That was pretty cool, watching boxing. We got a lot of free tickets to go to different venues, and I went and did that. I don't remember going to much swimming, but I remember going to boxing. But I was really glued to every track and field day. But the Jim Ryan's race against Kip Keno, just fast. I thought for sure that Kip Keno had made a mistake, because he at altitude you can't run real fast, too faster than what you can average. They said you couldn't run way the first part of a race too fast without paying a heavy price and being almost walking at the end. And he went out way faster than he could average for the whole thing. But that's the way he beat Jim Ryan. That was a pretty, I kept saying, oh, he's going to be walking the last lap. He's going to be walking the last lap, and Jim Ryan's going to catch him. And Jim Ryan was catching him, and he was about walking the last 50 meters, but he made got enough distance between the two of them that he won. But he had the help of a teammate, Ben Gipcho, to win it, who led the pace, so he didn't have to push that pace all by himself.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two things. You know, in the 200 meters, it was an incredible race with Tommy Smith. His knees were pumping up there like pistons. It was a great race.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the main races that I remember.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the 400 meters, I think we got 1-2-3. That was a close race, but Lee Evans won that race.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What do you think is the legacy of the 68 team?
Oh, man. Well, I think it was one of the greatest track and field teams the U.S. ever put together. I mean, I don't think that we'd ever gone 1-2-3 in the 400. Won so many, got so many gold medals. Had Bob Beamon's incredible record. There was incredible. People even now talk about how that was a special Olympics. You know, I mean, that so many different things. I mean, it was unique for the black raising their hands. That was kind of unique. And in the freedom that we had, the freedom from fear of being hurt by, you know, terrorists. And it was the last games that were like that, where you could bring your relatives even into the Olympic village. So that's kind of that it was the last real, more relaxed Olympics where you weren't worried about the political situation in the world and getting shot at.
Right. Well, yeah. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Well, I think today's Olympic hopefuls have to be successful and make the Olympic Games. They have to give up so much, and fortunately, they should take advantage to all the financial perks they have, and just dedicate themselves to their sport and be willing to realize that at the level of making the Olympic team, it's the ones that most people are pretty equal in ability at that level. It's just the ones that are who work the hardest and have the best mental attitude are going to win.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thought on it.
And Tracy, how are you still involved with your sport today? What's your role today?
Well, I'm still involved with distance runners. I'm a head cross country coach at the high school that I'm at, and assistant track coach doing the distance, coaching distance runners. And I have a running camp every year, and I've had running classes. I don't have them now, but when I lived down in Bishop, California, I had 13 years of running classes for adults and younger kids, just teaching people how to run. Mainly it was adults that wanted to get fit and wanted to learn how to do it. And it was all patterned after Bill Bowerman's, the Nike founder. He wrote a book years and years ago called Jogging, and how he started getting people that were even cardiac patients physically fit in Oregon. And I bought that book and started people going in Bishop, and man, it ballooned. I was doing pretty well for quite a few years doing that.
Very cool.
Helped a lot of people learn how to get fit and lose weight and get healthy.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today and for sharing your memories and being generous with your time and memories.
Yeah, you're welcome. I hope it'll be interesting to somebody.